Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today. Thank you for listening in. I've been gone from Local Talk for a few weeks, and it feels good to be back. Really feel the absence of Mr. Dennis Hart, who usually is sitting here with me on Mondays. Mr. Hart has gone back to California for the winter. However, I'm very appreciative of the many different people who've been hosting Local Talk recently, some old pros and some newcomers, reestablishing again that Local Talk is the sound of community. And I look forward to sharing this show with many, many more community members as co-hosts. Today is a windy, wet day, windy and wet, possibly some sun today, but also mostly chances of showers, especially again as the evening goes on. Temperatures should be around 54, and we'll be seeing an end to the balmy temperatures we've been enjoying. Although it's been suggested that Wednesday could get as high as 58 degrees, we are headed more into the low 50s and high 40s this week. We'll be in and out of wet weather all week, and Thursday night it's predicted to go below freezing in the 20s. So the weekend is expected to be sunny but chilly in the low 40s. So it is happening. Please stay with us for the next hour, where we'll be hearing a recording of the late Paul Nelson, somebody who meant a great deal to many of us here in the community and who was also very pivotal to KHOI and to several other circles in town, in Ames. Later in the show, Drew Kemp, Director of the Public Policy for the Ames Chamber of Commerce, will be here with Lawrence Cunningham, Chair of the Public Policy Committee of the Ames Chamber. And they're going to be talking about the importance of elections. Election Day is coming up. But the digital Dennis is here to bring you the news. So we'll go first with a summary of the Iowa news. Here's digital Dennis.
Thanks very much. It is great to be back here on Local Talk again. There was plenty of news around the state last week, including new developments in the story of the man accused of killing University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts. The state of Iowa agreed that some of the statements made by defendant Christian Bahena Rivera should not be used as evidence against him at trial because he had not properly been informed of his rights. Meanwhile, Bahena Rivera's trial was delayed again. It is now set to take place next February 4th. His lawyers had asked for the delay because of new evidence they had recently received. If Bahena Rivera is convicted of first-degree murder, he will be sentenced to life in prison. In the world of politics last week, word that a new CBS poll showed the Democratic presidential hopefuls Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren are tied for the lead here in Iowa, with the upcoming caucuses less than 4 months away. Both Biden and Warren have 22% of the vote of potential caucus-goers, with Bernie Sanders just 1 point back at 21%. Pete Buttigieg is fourth at 14%. Warren will appear in Ames today, Monday, at 5 o'clock at Stevens Auditorium at the Iowa State Center. Meanwhile, the Des Moines Register reported last week that Sanders and Biden spent the most campaign money in Iowa in the third quarter of this year. Sanders spent $460,000. Biden spent $409,000. The next biggest spender, Andrew Yang, weighing in at $263,000. Still on the political beat, Iowa Farm and Renewable Group said last week that a proposal released by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency failed to keep President Trump's promise to boost the sagging market for ethanol and biodiesel. Since taking office, the Trump administration has granted 85 waivers to oil refineries, waivers that freed them from using 4 billion gallons of renewable fuel. Also last week, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said she would continue pushing for ways to reduce bias in the state's criminal justice system, including pushing a constitutional amendment next year to give felons the right to vote. Meanwhile, there was a report last week that claimed the Midwest lacks the support, resources, and equity for the black community. The report was authored by the Iowa Policy Project and claims that progress on racial equality has slowed or stalled on many fronts since the civil rights movement. Iowa was one of 12 states surveyed. On the money beat, Governor Reynolds made $10 million in workforce housing tax credits available for reconstruction or replacement of homes damaged by flooding this past year. 10 counties along the Missouri and Mississippi rivers would qualify for the next tax credit. Meanwhile, a state budget panel said Iowa's revenue will grow by 1.4% in the current fiscal year before picking up slightly next year. And there was also word that Wells Fargo plans to beef up its home lending staff in the Des Moines metro because more people than expected are buying homes and refinancing mortgages. Also last week, two Guthrie County sheriff's deputies were shot and wounded during an attempt to serve the suspect with an arrest warrant. The suspect was also injured. None of those injuries were life-threatening. Meanwhile, this past weekend, a law enforcement pursuit that reached speeds of 120 miles an hour ended in a fatal accident near Story City. The fleeing driver refused to stop and crashed into an unoccupied vehicle. That driver died from his injuries. There was also word last week that a daycare center in Donaldson that had been implicated in the death of an infant last year had received citations for 22 more violations. The citations by the Iowa Department of Human Services against Raise 'em Up Early Daycare followed the death of 4-month-old Jack Rowland, who was found unresponsive there last December. There was also a story that a former administrative assistant who had sued the Waukee School District over allegations that she was wrongfully terminated for exposing wrongdoing by its former chief operating officer had reached a $1 million settlement with the district. The school board approved the settlement with Amy Patters on Tuesday. Meanwhile, the State Court of Appeals has decided to hear arguments in a case in which Democratic Party lawmakers and lawyers sued Governor Reynolds, challenging a new law that gives the governor more power over the selection of Supreme Court and Appeals Court judges. There was also word last week that the number of known cases of sexual harassment committed by employees in Iowa's executive branch spiked last year after responsibility for conducting investigations was shifted to a central agency. At Iowa State University here in Ames, officials said things had to change after the results of a survey on sexual misconduct were released last week. That survey showed that 11% of students experienced some sort of assault or non-consensual sexual contact since starting college. At the University of Iowa last week, word that the university was in the final stages of negotiating with a handful of potential partners to operate its $1 billion utilities system. The goal is to find an outside company that would operate the U of I utility system for at least 50 years. Also last week, the Des Moines Register and its annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa made news. The marketing team behind RagBri resigned on Tuesday because of fallout from the way the Register had handled one of its stories on Carson King, the Altoona man who had raised more than $3 million for Children's Hospital in Iowa City. That former marketing team announced a new bike ride, which will take place next July during the same week that RagBri is scheduled. The Register announced RagBri would still take place. Stay tuned. In Des Moines, there was word of a new study that showed the city needs to invest $30 million to expand the county soccer complex if it wants to attract the region's biggest soccer tournaments. The money would double the size of the Southside Sports Park, adding 12 fields on 87 acres south of the existing fields. This new study came less than a month after Come and Go CEO Kyle Krause announced his plans to bring a USL Championship soccer team to Des Moines, something that is contingent on a $60 million new stadium near downtown. Also last week, the Des Moines City Council gave final approval to the city's new zoning code, its first update since 1965. That new code establishes minimum square foot requirements, meaning that all new homes built in Des Moines will have to measure at least 1,100 to 1,800 square feet, depending on location and the number of stories. Also in Des Moines, word that a developer who is known for rehabilitating distressed homes in the city had proposed his first new construction project, but is encountering resistance from neighbors. Ryan Francois, who owns Rally Camp Properties, wants to build 7 row homes on a vacant lot on High Street between 23rd and 24th Streets in Des Moines. But neighbors of the proposed project in Woodland Heights are pushing back against what would be added density in their neighborhood. Still in Des Moines, the lights were tested on a new bridge that will connect pedestrians and hikers from Grays Lake to the downtown area. The nearly $4 million bridge will take its users over the Raccoon River, connecting a new urban development on the north side of the river to a trail that circles Grays Lake on the south side. The new bridge will be lit at night with a variety of patterns and colors. And, in another story, the Three Bridges flag will again fly above Des Moines. The city council voted to approve the display of the red, white, and blue flag as the capital city's official banner. That banner, with 3 white arched bridges spanning a blue background, was first adopted 45 years ago, but was phased out in 2008 when the city adopted a new logo. In Warren County, the Zoning Board of Adjustment approved a special use permit to let Indianola build a nearly $35 million wastewater treatment plant north of the city. That decision ended a month-long dispute that included the city filing a lawsuit against the county board. The Board of Adjustment had denied the city's first request for a special use permit last year, citing concerns of nearby residents. There was a story about a stolen car and a stolen dog last week, and it had a happy ending. Seems a Des Moines woman had her car stolen from in front of a convenience store. Inside the car was her dog, a Chihuahua and Terrier mix named Jasper. The woman used her Find My iPhone app and discovered that her vehicle had been taken to Omaha. So she called the Nebraska Humane Society to find out if a tiny dog with a red shirt had been brought in. Yes, indeed, one had been, and yes, indeed, it was Jasper the dog. That made Jasper's owner very happy indeed, and she got even happier when her car was recovered as well. In the world of college football this past Saturday, Iowa State defeated Texas Tech 34-24. The University of Iowa defeated Purdue 26-20. And the University of Northern Iowa defeated South Dakota 42-27. And one more story before I go, and it's about alcohol. A new study released last week showed that Iowa residents start to feel intoxicated, yes, intoxicated, between their third and fourth beers. Now you might wonder who in the world would conduct such a survey. Glad you asked. It was conducted by Alcohol.org, a subsidiary of American Addiction Centers. Those folks surveyed residents of all 50 states, not just Iowa. They asked respondents how many beers they can drink in one sitting before they start feeling the effects. Turns out, Iowa's beer tolerance ranks 26th among the 50 states. Residents in Arizona and Michigan can drink the most beers without feeling the effects, about 4 beers. Americans with the lowest tolerance for beer live in Hawaii and Idaho. People there can down only about 2 3/4 beers before they're feeling intoxicated. So now you know. And aren't you glad you listened? And now I'm starting to feel the effects of reading the more than 24 stories that made up today's summary of the past week's news from around Iowa. So I think I'll wrap this all up and take the rest of the day off. But I'll return on Friday with a look at what makes news this week in Ames. I'm Dennis Hart. Have a great week.
Dusty road, it's a hot and a heavy load, and the people that I meet aren't always kind. Some are bad and some are good, some have done the best they could, some have tried to ease my troubling mind. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound. I've been all around this land, just a doing the best I can, just a trying to find out what I've meant to do. But the people that I see, they just look the same as me, and it seems like they're bound to wander. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound.
Take it, John.
Girl one time, she had lips like cherry wine, and I loved her till my head went plumb insane. But I was too blind to see that she was drifting away from me, and my good gal, she left on the morning train. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound. Well, if you see me passing by, and you sit and you wonder why, and you think that you might like to be around the two, well, nail your shoes to the kitchen floor, lace them up and bar the door. Thank your stars for the roof that's over. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound. No, I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound. Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Local Talk. If you've just joined us, I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today. We've been listening to the Pool Hall Waltz Band. That was Mr. Paul Nelson singing lead for the Pool Hall Waltz Band. This is a homemade CD that it says on it, not for sale or commercial distribution of any sort. There's like a little homemade label in here that I can read. Pool Hall Waltz Band consisted of Jim Kraft, John Hersey, Mickey Hersey, and Paul Nelson. I'm reading here from the cover. During the 70s and early 80s, the Pool Hall Waltz Band made music in around Ames, Iowa, an eclectic mix of folk, rhythm and blues, bluegrass, Cajun, 60s and 70s rock, heavily spiced with an even more eclectic mix of four incorrigible stage hogs with delusions of adequacy. But it was great fun. Great is uppercase. Peace rallies and Democratic fundraisers, Dugan's, the Maintenance Shop, the Skunk River Cafe, Stumpy's, Thumbs Up, weddings, hog roasts, Harkin steak fries, almost any event that promised something to eat, drink, and maybe some money for strings. When Jim Kraft died in a motorcycle accident in 1981, the magic left. These CDs were produced from a few remaining cassettes and reel-to-reel tapes recorded at performances in the late 70s. Dugan's Deli and Stumpy's can be identified, possibly a Maintenance Shop cut, and a session or two in John Hersey's basement in Kelly. They are definitely not studio quality, not at all for the golden-eared listener, but for those who were in our audiences, they might bring back some good times and shared memories. I hope they do. They do for me. Paul Nelson, May 2006. The cover is, the writing has slices of oranges behind it, which is kind of puzzling.
Well, they said they show up for food.
So. Show up for food. I guess that's what it is. And I'm here with Cynthia McClure, the engineer. Thank you for being with me, Cynthia. There's a little photograph here of these guys performing at the Maintenance Shop. You can see the stained glass windows behind them, and Mr. Paul Nelson is standing in front singing that song that we just heard. And he sounded mighty good.
Yes, he did.
He did. And in the wake of Paul's passing, I wanted to share that recording. And also a recording that I made with him in 2017. He was already ill at the time and was homebound. So we were sitting in his kitchen, accompanied by one of his two very magnificent and beautiful black cats named George. George was had a lot of personality. I hope he's well, having a conversation about the beginning of KHOI and the spirit and the people that built it and what it meant to him. Building KHOI took up the majority of Paul's time after he retired. We kind of filled up his life.
Yeah, quite a bit.
especially
when the tower would go down and he would have to troubleshoot how to make it work.
Yeah. Until he became homebound in around 2017. In his death, he left support for KHOI as well.
Oh, bless him.
Which we're very appreciative.
And especially now.
Especially now. I know that I would have Paul's total approval in taking a minute to talk about KHOI in context of his death. Most of us at KHOI, myself included, shy away from talking about the station on the air. We're here to talk about people, places, and things looking outward to the community. But I am going to take a minute to talk about KHOI upon the recommendation of many people, including Mr. Dennis Hart. Dennis, you've told me a million times to talk about this, so let's talk for a minute about the station, because transparency and honesty with the listener is the hallmark of community radio. And so I do want to be honest with you about the station. We're going into a fund drive. The funding campaign will start on November 6th, which is the day after Election Day. That's kind of always when we kick off our end-of-the-year fund drive, KHOI. And we aim for 2 weeks, but really, honestly, we go until the end of December or until we reach our goal. Mm-hmm. And our goal this year is $50,000. It's a little bit more than we've asked for before, but frankly, we absolutely need it.
Yeah.
It is a necessity if we want to make it through the next year. As you know, this is the time of the year when people do their major giving, so this is the most crucial time for KHOI. And if we reach $50,000, we will stop fundraising, I promise. So if you would like to start donating early, then we'll just get it over with quicker.
Yeah.
So, yes, we will take donations now. But just kind of to warn you, we will start pitching to you on November 6th. And we are doing so asking for $50,000 because, and this is the part that I've been urged to be frank about, KHOI is currently in the red. It is not safe to assume that this station is here securely. It is quite frankly not right now financially. In October, we did go into the red, and we're borrowing Peter to pay Paul right now to stay on the air through this month.
So have you ever driven your car and you're just riding on fumes? That's KHOI.
That's KHOI right now.
We're riding on fumes.
Yeah. Now, granted, this is always the leanest time of the year, so it's not a big surprise that we're in this state, but it is a little bit surprised that it's this bad and that we're this close to extinction. So when we come to you in November, we are being very, very sincere. This is about whether KHOI can be part of the Central Iowa community or not, whether Central Iowa wants to have a community radio station. I think it's a great thing. I think a lot of deaf people do, and tremendous amount of energy and very, very serious professional work has gone into making the station possible. It's not a flaky operation, even though we're volunteers. It's a very serious undertaking. I think this interview with Paul Nelson reflects that and kind of gives you a sense of what went into building the station. So let's just go to this interview with Paul. It's also a chance to spend some time with somebody that we all very, very much miss right now. We are hoping to have a celebration for Paul here at the station soon. Involves a lot of people, so nothing has been
put. And food will be.
Food, and we hope music.
Trust me, I will be bringing yummy food.
We also have a video of Paul when we went on the air, which is quite delightful. So we're going to do something. We just have to get all the cats herded in a row.
Okay, let's do this.
Let's listen to Paul. Okay, and again, this is sitting in Paul's kitchen in 2017 with his cat, George.
I'm Paul Nelson, Chief Engineer for KHOI Community Radio, and when I got involved with the project, it was still headquartered at the Baptist Church, and it was still a sort of an internet radio station, and that was new to me. But the challenges of taking this thing from that kind of activity to a full-fledged radio station, I think it appealed to my sense of utter futility.
Futility? Why you said futility?
Just that. That's just a joke, really.
You spent a significant amount of your retirement time actually working on KHOI. You helped us get the station on the air, because it's been a lot of work. Are you glad that you dedicated so much of your retirement time to the station or not?
I am glad. First of all, I learned a lot of things that were new to me that I never would have learned otherwise. I used some of my education that I never would have used otherwise, I think.
You were an electrical engineer as a profession?
Yeah, a combination, actually, of electrical and industrial. I was a so-called manufacturing engineer, production engineer, and it was my job out at my company, Sauer Danfoss, which is now Danfoss. It was my job to design production test equipment and to integrate computers and electronics into that equipment so it all worked together automatically. Industrial automation, that sort of thing. But radio has always been a part of my life. I've been an amateur radio operator for many, many years, as was my father before me. And to that extent, I found it an easy transition.
I asked you to help out with this project. Why did you agree to even get involved in the first place?
Well, there were several reasons. It appealed to my sense of a complex project, one that needed a lot of different disciplines. You had asked me something about this, I think, several years previously. I think when the filing window came open in 2007, we talked on the telephone. I was still working then, and I said that I did not have time to get involved with this, and I was still working. The next time you were here, and it was a different scenario. I had been retired for about a year. It just kind of went from there. So I agreed to get involved, and I tried to make myself useful wherever I could, but it was very, very shortly that I got really heavily involved with developing the tower site and then finding a suitable transmitter shelter, which was a great breakthrough. And I think that cost us $9,000, and it was the first money, I think, that we actually spent, the first big purchase we made. And it really felt good, because it felt like once we had that thing, could a radio station not follow? And then there was negotiating the tower lease with American Tower, and that was quite a different level of hell. But in the end, it worked out quite well. We got a very good deal on that lease.
You said you learned things. What's something that you learned?
How thick the FCC regulations are. And how...
Yeah, people think we make that up.
And how densely they are printed. That's an incredible thing. I'll give you one example. In terms of emergency operation, or let's say what to do when the power goes out or the transmitter goes off or we don't have audio or whatever, there's a voluminous portion of those regulations that deal with those kinds of issues. And I remember Roger Parmenter and I, and later Eric, poring over those regulations, trying to figure just what we could get away with at the transmitter site and what we absolutely had to buy and install to make things legal. And sometimes there weren't very clear answers. But I think what we did out there finally at the transmitter site does hold its own, because there have been a number of times that we've lost power out there for a considerable period of time, and when power comes back, everything comes up automatically. We start transmitting. The link between the studio and the tower site comes back, and we're back on the air. And that pleases me no end. It saves a lot of gas.
It's a tremendous accomplishment that you're describing, that you with the help of others pulled off. So do you still enjoy being involved, and to the extent that you are?
Very much.
Why is that?
It's something that I never would have thought that I would be involved with when you first asked me to be involved. I just never thought about it, and then all of a sudden I found myself immersed in it, and I've said before it's like drinking from a fire hose. But the water's cool and tasty, I've found. And the other thing that I have absolutely enjoyed is the people that I've found involved with community radio. Both here, a lot of these people that we have here I've known for years, as you have. The people that I have met at grassroots radio conferences and the people who helped us get on the air. Incredible folks. Top notch. I learned a hell of a lot.
I think that's a good word to describe community radio people. They're top notch.
I'd agree. Mm-hmm. I'd agree.
Yeah.
Incredible folks. Who knew they were out there? I didn't. You did. And you sucked them in here. And I think that's great.
Looking back so far on what you did with KHOI, what would you say was one of your favorite memories? What comes to mind when you think of the good times? I mean, it wasn't always good times. There was a lot of stress, too. But what would you say is something that you'll enjoy looking back on?
I think the most compelling thing that I can say is the day we went on the air, the couple of days that, or maybe more than that, that were involved in getting the antenna up onto that tower, installing the equipment in the transmitter shelter at the base, working with the tower climbing folks and with Tom Voorhees. That man is nothing short of amazing and incredible. Mm-hmm. Who came down to help us, and so did David Klan and Todd Fisher Wallen, mm-hmm. who was unfortunately passed away. Those folks just sort of bounded down from where they were, got out of their cars, sprang into the transmitter site, went to work, and got things done.
Mm-hmm. Community radio was seen as a volunteer project, and maybe it doesn't always register the level of accomplishment and really high level of professionalism that's involved with really running an operation like this, that the folks that make community radio happen are not flaky people. They're quite the opposite. They're people who are just incredibly independent and live to a very, very high professional standard to make this happen. And often outside the realm of profit.
That's really very true. The volunteer nature of community radio. Sometimes I wonder how these people live. Before I retired, I couldn't get along without a direct paying job. Mm-hmm. But a lot of these people seem to.
Yeah, community radio is a system that really, to a large extent, lives outside of personal financial gain.
It does. Tom Voorhees is an excellent example of that.
And a lot of the syndicated programs you hear, almost every one of them, the productions are done without payment.
It's amazing.
Yeah. The programs are provided by the producers.
That's right.
You know, at no cost, which is extraordinary because the productions are excellent.
They really are. The syndicated programs that we carry on KHOI are nothing but top-notch, mm-hmm. and they're free. I've never met more professional people than those that I've gotten in touch with through that effort that we made.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. There's a story that I heard at Todd's funeral. Todd was one of the engineers that helped us get on the air. Mm-hmm. He died suddenly last summer from an accident. And I went to his funeral in Wisconsin. This is kind of an example of what we're talking about. At his funeral, people were talking, you know, we're kind of relating their memories, and one of his friends was describing a cross-country trip he took with Todd, where Todd insisted driving 50 miles an hour the whole time and drove his friend crazy. And he said, because, you know, Todd didn't want to break the law. And the next person that stood up, which I think was David Klan, he said, no, you don't understand. Todd wasn't driving 50 miles an hour because of any law. He was driving 50 miles an hour because that is the speed at which the highest efficiency is for using gasoline. And everybody was like, oh, yeah, that sounds exactly right.
That's exactly right.
So, Paul, at this point in the juncture, to mix a metaphor. I mean, we definitely are not done yet. There's lots of work to do. What wisdom can you impart?
Buy low, sell high? No. I think it's hard for me to really say because, like many people who frequent the doors down at the Pantorium, I don't have a clue what will make that enterprise work better than it does. But we need more funding, we're starting to get some real recognition in Ames by people who otherwise wouldn't give us this shirt off their backs or anything else for that matter. KHOI provides a voice that is not heard anywhere else in Ames and in very few places in Iowa.
You were really one of the people that built KHOI.
Yeah.
You know, when we say this is a precious enterprise and has really, you know, been the labor of not only top-notch effort, but also real, you know, intentions of integrity and altruism, you really saw that intimately. You saw the process and everything that was involved. So you can really, in a sense, testify that, in fact, that those words really are very true in this case. This is not a spin. This is not a sell job. This is what it is.
You are absolutely right. A sell job or a spin job, it is not. The concept of volunteerism and the concept of caring, the concept of
wanting to make a better world, right?
Wanting to make a better world, of bringing voices to the public that have no other chance of being heard. Some of the most important things that I think that we can possibly do. And to this point in Ames, it had not been done. So KHOI is providing a real service there. And it's a service that I'm constantly in awe of.
Do you think we're helping to build community in Ames and Central Iowa?
I do, mm-hmm. Very much.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, you're most welcome.
What do you think?
I think it's a very nice interview. What do you think?
It needs a little editing.
Welcome back. This is Local Talk. I'm Ursula Rudenberg here with Cynthia McClure. Thanks, Cynthia. The music is the Pool Hall Waltz Band playing live at some venue in Ames in the 1970s. Mr. Paul Nelson, one of the creators of the KHOI and beloved
Friend and colleague to many in this town was the person you heard in the band with his friends and also in the interview prior to the music. Paul passed away last weekend. We are planning a memorial gathering here at KHOI with live music and potluck food, but involves a lot of people, so we will keep you posted on when that actually will be possible. We've been joined by Drew Kemp, Director of Public Policy for Ames Chamber of Commerce, and also Lawrence Cunningham, Chair of the Public Policy Committee for Ames Chamber. Thank you for coming in, guys.
Thanks, Ursula.
I know that you are here essentially in anticipation of the upcoming election, and we want to talk about elections. But before we do that, explain a little bit what exactly the Public Policy Committee is for the Ames Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, I'll start a little bit and talk a little bit about what we do. And really, if you look at the chamber, there's kind of four pillars or tenets that everything's based on. It's based on education, engagement, leadership, and advocacy. And really, advocacy obviously has its own arm, but it really falls into that engagement and education and kind of a broad cross-section. Of the entire four pillars altogether, because if you don't have effective advocacy, you can't have really any of the other pieces. But you really also want to make sure that you're educating people so they can make informed decisions at the ballot box or whenever they're advocating on a specific issue or a specific topic.
What do you mean by advocacy?
Advocacy, I would really just say that's more so just kind of trying to push a message or make sure that you have an understanding or of an issue. Like, for example, a lot of the times you'll see things in Ames and Iowa, we have a lot of involvement in obviously ag tech, renewables, biorenewables, things along those lines. So those are going to be a lot of our advocacy issues. You know, you're looking at some of your targeted industries, you know, things that impact advanced manufacturing, animal health, food science, bioscience, ag, renewables, whether that's renewable energy or renewable fuels. Those are all things that we have a heightened awareness of because they're so important to this area. And then an advocate is obviously someone that advocates on behalf of those issues. And then that's effective advocacy is if you're advocating on issues that you believe in that are important to your community, to your individual, to your organization, to whatever it may be.
So you're saying that the chamber takes a position on various legislation in the state of Iowa. Is that what you're saying?
At the local level, the county level, the state level, and the federal level, yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I noticed on the website for the Public Policy Committee, there's a list of good bills, bad bills.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are where the chamber says where it what position it takes on various bills. Right now it's empty because mm-hmm. There's no legislature in process.
It should be populated here going into the session because we're in the middle of one of the general assemblies. So you can still carry bills over from the previous assembly from 2019 mm-hmm. to 2020. But really what that is it's just really bills we support, bills we're indifferent or we're undecided on, and bills that we oppose.
And that's only
at the state level.
Now, when the chamber takes those positions, how does it know that it's representing its constituents?
Well, we're working a lot with chambers throughout the state, but then mm-hmm. we're also working with our members through the Government Affairs Committee and then also just through general interactions and general discussions and just word of mouth that we're having with people. But a lot of the times it's with our partner organizations. We partner with business organizations, chamber organizations, development organizations. That's one of the biggest things as advocacy. The best things you can do is partner with people. So we partner with great people like Lawrence and people on our board, but then also other individuals throughout the community and state that kind of help us and advocate and kind of think along the same lines on that big business advocacy kind of thing.
Okay, well, let's bring Lawrence into it. Lawrence is the manager of the Iowa State Daily.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the correct title, actually.
No, my responsibility is to oversee the business side of the operations.
Uh-huh. And what is the actual group called?
The Iowa State Daily Media Group.
Media Group, mm-hmm. right. So, Lawrence, tell us what you do on the Chamber of Commerce. What is your role there?
Yeah, so I'm in a volunteer leadership position. So I oversee I serve as the liaison between the committee, our member base, and the staff at the chamber and help guide public policy, our priorities from a legislative perspective. But when you ask Drew about how do we make sure that we are representing our stakeholders, right? The chamber is a business membership organization, and so our stakeholders are local businesses. And so when we talk about public policy and advocacy, it's really built around creating an environment that's going to be successful for businesses to operate over time. And so that's really kind of what my role is and what the role of the chamber is relative to advocacy.
And can you describe a little bit the conversations or the scenarios that occur where the opinions of your stakeholders are
are expressed?
Yeah, I think Chamber does such a great job of outreach. And so they have a series of community tools in terms of email newsletters, engagement meetings. We certainly have committee meetings to talk about advocating for different issues. Also educational and listening sessions as well, where the Chamber is providing information and seeking feedback from that perspective. And so I think it really helps to educate business owners and business managers about how these issues could positively or negatively affect the environment with which we do business. And so I think those are some of the things that we're doing routinely.
Do you find that businesses are outspoken in this community?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of businesses who are, and I don't know if outspoken is exactly the right word. I think they're vocal relative to, you know, what they think is going to positively impact their business. I think one of the educational components of what the chamber does is they create these opportunities for elected officials and the membership base to engage and support dialogue. And I think, you know, in those environments, you get a lot of really good dialogue back and forth about what the issues look like and how it's going to impact local government, how it's going to impact business. And so I think there is really good dialogue, but I don't know if it's if I would classify it as sort of outspoken.
Okay, well, let's talk about elections. What do you feel is important, Drew, as we head into this election time? What is the message from the chamber?
Well, really what we want to do is we talked about how we are all about education and engagement and leadership and really getting people to be participative in the civic and voting process. And a lot of people, especially in local elections, it remains to be seen this year, because one of the important things to note is this year is the first year that we have the new voting system in place. And what I mean by that is that it's the first year the school and the city election are on the same day. If you recall, the school election used to be back in September. The turnout was always lower, unfortunately. And then the city election would be in November. They decided to put them together for a multitude of different reasons a couple of years ago down at the legislature. And this is the first year that we're going to see on November 5th those elections happen together. And what's so hugely important is just if you look at your property tax for the FY 2020, the current fiscal year that ends on June 30th, about 45% of your taxes go to the school district, and about 33% of your taxes go to the city. So quick math, that's about 78% of your taxes that are on the ballot this year, the ballot this November 5th.
That's a big percentage.
That's a very big percentage. And as we've talked about all the time, I talk about with Lawrence, I've talked about with you before, and just our members and anyone who will really listen, is just the fact that it's kind of disappointing that you see the participation rate when there's that much of an impact on your pocketbook and with your tax dollars. But then it's also that adage that all politics is local really is true, and we really do see it as we go through a lot of different issues, whether it be with the school board or whether it be with the city council and mayor. There's some really big issues that we have to take on at both both elected bodies at the school board and at the council. And it's going to be really important that we have the right people in the right seats to really lead the city and the school district forward.
Yeah, we were saying before we went on the air that this is not a very glamorous election year, but it actually is very impactful on a local level, that it actually has a lot of effect on the people voting.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And not to forget either that we have three individuals going up on for re-election, incumbents all going up for re-election on the Mary Greeley Medical Center Board of Trustees. And they do an excellent job overseeing the resources they have there as well in unison with the administration, just like at the city and the school district. But it's important to know they are up too, and they have some really big and important things going on at the hospital. They just recently got approval of a $35 million bond to do some improvements at the hospital. So that's something that can't be forgotten either.
Yeah, that's huge, right? Yeah. Okay, so help us focus in a little bit on what is exactly at stake here. Lawrence, Drew, you want to?
Yeah, I think when you look at this election cycle, you look at we're voting on city government decision makers. We're voting on education.
City government meaning city council members?
City council, right.
So there's one seat essentially being contested, right?
There's
city council.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. With three candidates.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No,
go
that's
ahead.
Great. So we're talking about city council, so city government decision making, school board. So we're talking about education within our community, and we're talking about the Mary Greeley Board of Trustees. So we're talking about healthcare. So three incredibly important components of our daily lives. And this is where we, I think, have a personal responsibility as community members to engage in this process and make sure that we're electing individuals who are going to represent our interests the way that we decide, so that we can move forward and support the decisions decisions that they're elected to make. So I think we have a personal responsibility to get out and be engaged, and that's a big part of why I'm excited to partner with the Chamber and be part of that advocacy arm.
So what do you do other than come on KHOI? How do you how do you do that advocacy?
Yeah, we spend a lot of time informing and educating, right? And and that's a big part of what our responsibility is. I think in
And you do that through
through community outreach, through individual meetings, through coffee talks, through presentations, right? Through legislative sessions where we have luncheons and after hours and those sorts of events. And so really I think it's helping to make sure that in the daily minutiae that we all have and all the responsibilities that we have, that this remains front of mind as opposed to something that can kind of get swallowed up in your day-to-day offering. So our job is to help make sure that people are thinking about this so that their engagement level increases and their likelihood to vote increases as well.
Mm-hmm. So the main message I'm hearing from both of you is that this election really counts and that it's important to really participate. That's essentially what I'm hearing.
Very much so, yes. And just to kind of piggyback on what Lawrence was just saying too, when we have individuals, whether they're people coming in looking at the university or people coming in looking at working at one of our great businesses, one of the two of the things they always want to know about is education and healthcare, but also the city government. So the three things that are on the ballot, these are questions that are top of mind for individuals, whether they're here or they're relocating here or they're deciding if they're going to stay here. So those are things that it's really important that you have the right leaders in those positions to really make sure that we're moving things forward. As I mentioned before, we have some really, really big decisions to make at all three of those levels, at Mary Greeley, at the school district, and at the city council dais. So it's really important to make sure that you have the people that you feel are representing your ideals and your concepts and your kind of opinions on that respective elective body. So we really want to make sure we're pushing participation. We make as many resources as available possible, possibly available. And really, one of the things you'll see today in our weekly newsletter is you're going to see our videos that we partnered with Iowa State Media, Iowa State Daily Media Group, and Model Farm to do some videos with the city council candidates. And then you'll have questionnaires coming out for the Mary Greeley Medical Center Board of Trustees candidates, as well as Gilbert and Ames School Board candidates, to really give you an idea as a chamber member as to what their opinions are and who may fall in line best with your ideals and what you kind of think the best leadership looks like going forward.
And we should talk about those videos for just a minute, because this is something that's new and a little bit different for the chamber. Historically, we've had these legislative luncheons where people are able to come in and listen to those that are running for the positions on their own. But I think what we found is that it's difficult for enough questions to be asked to get a really good flavor for where the candidates sit. And so we moved to a video format because of the massive increase in consumption that people have on video when they're online. And so this allows all of the stakeholders to be able to consume the information in a time that works for them. And it's a more thorough representation of where the candidate sits on the issues that are most important to the stakeholders of our organization. So we're pretty excited about those videos.
Absolutely. And you also can look at the candidate and see what you think of them in terms of the look in their eyes. And
you're exactly right.
Yeah. And where are the videos available?
They're going to be available on our weekly legislative update, our local policy update that will be coming out sometime today. And then they'll be available on our website, our social media, and then also on weekly emails and such. So they're going to be available in a lot of different resources and a lot of different outlets. But one of the most important things, too, I want to point out is that we're also making them available to the candidates. So not only are our members benefiting from it, the candidates can then share them far and wide however they deem appropriate. So it's a mutually beneficial partnership, which is really important. And we were really lucky to partner with Lawrence and his team to really make that a reality.
Well, and that website is ameschamber.com.
Yes, it is. Yeah, ameschamber.com. And then click on public policy. It'll take you right to where all those will be nested.
Okay. Making democracy work, right?
We're trying.
Okay. We have to head out, but I'll give you guys the last word. Any final thing you'd like to say before we head out of the show?
I would really just like to push. Election day is November 5th, so do make sure you get out and vote. There's about 20 polling locations available throughout the community. If you don't live in Ames, go to the Secretary of State's website. You can find any place in the state of Iowa as to where you need to vote. If you can't make it on November 5th, find a way to get out and vote absentee. It's really important to make your voice heard.
Okay. Lawrence?
What a treat it was to be with you all this morning. KHOI plays such an important role in our community, and so it's really nice to have you here. Thank you for allowing us to join you.
Thank you, Lawrence. Thanks for your support to KHOI and just encouraging what we're doing here. Really appreciate it. And you have been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg. I've been here with Cynthia McClure, engineering. Thank you, Drew Kemp, Director of Public Policy for the Ames Chamber of Commerce, and Lawrence Cunningham, Chair of the Public Policy Committee for the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI. Also remember, you can hear it at khoifm.org. Recordings of this show later, and we do stream live at khoifm.org. My theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Chelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we will train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio. Funding for KHOI comes in part from the Iowa State Center, bringing you AILEY 2, merging the spirit and energy of young talent and passion with creative vision. Information can be found at center.iastate.edu. That's center.iastate.edu.